Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 21st. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with today's mini editorial, which is written by Greg Taylor of Marcus, Iowa. And Greg writes, "What a shame. The president gets cut off by the first lady again. Folks, tune out the mainstream media, then you will see what is really going on. This president and his administration is not only incompetent, they are dangerous. One calamity after another. The blame game finger points straight back to, well, you should know. The longer we let this go on, well, you know the old saying." Again, this was written by Greg Taylor of Marcus, Iowa. Our first article has a headline of Morningside Apartment Proposal Gets Go-Ahead. The Sioux City Council unanimously voted Monday to approve a site plan for a proposed apartment complex on Morningside Avenue, on the condition that the location of a dumpster enclosure be moved to the south. The site plan for the 24-unit, three-story apartment building at 1720 Morningside Avenue shows the proposed dumpster enclosure in the northwest corner of the site. Pickle Properties, which owns the property immediately to the north, appealed the Planning and Zoning Commission's decision to approve the site plan, specifically because of the location of a dumpster enclosure. Jason Geary, a member of the commission, said the developer had to come to the commission on appeal several times because of several deficiencies with the site plan that did not meet city code, such as setback and parking issues. He noted that neighbors have also expressed frustrations about the project and posed a number of questions related to water runoff. "If it wasn't such a dense project, do you think you could get rid of some of those difficult little quirks?" Mayor Bob Scott asked. 24 units seems like quite a few for that site. Geary told Scott that he thinks the building envelope is going to stay the same. He said dropping down from a three-story to a two-story building would lower the need for parking. "I assume the developer brought that forward because, based on the numbers, this is what they need to make it work. From a practical, common-sense perspective, I don't know how much you can really modify that site, even if you just take it down a story. And then, is it feasible to do that much concrete work and all that sort of stuff and make a cash flow?" Velma Ludwig, who lives on South St. Aubyn Street, raised concerns about more noise as well as traffic on the street and sidewalk. She said the proposed apartment building, which she described as stark, wouldn't fit the appearance of the Peters Park neighborhood. She noted that two other adjacent apartment buildings are older. "There's just too much traffic to add that many more people," Ludwig said. "The funeral home's guests do not have a place to park. They're parking in no parking areas. Is this the way to treat our visitors? To add more traffic?" Erin Nelson, who also lives on South St. Aubyn Street, said she is worried about noise from an HVAC system, which would be visible, as well as increased traffic and privacy and drainage issues. "There isn't any way to keep the runoff there. We already have erosion on both the front and the back. There is no storm sewer in all of Peters Park up there until you get halfway around that block." Developer Paul Kosovich told the council that no water is leaving the site and that the project will be an improvement in that regard for the neighbors. He said the dumpster enclosure was placed in northwest corner so that the driver of the roll-off truck could easily access it. "To ask a guy to go back in to drive around once a week, it's a nuisance," he said. In another article about the Sioux City Council, the council unanimously approves ordinance that prohibits owners from leaving pets in hot vehicles. The Sioux City Council unanimously voted Monday to adopt an ordinance that prohibits individuals from keeping animals in a vehicle or the bed of a parked truck when the outdoor temperature exceeds 79 degrees Fahrenheit, unless the animal is enclosed inside the vehicle with the air conditioning turned on. Previously, the city code had a non-specific requirement that animals not be kept in vehicles during conditions of temperature extremes. The new ordinance is adapted from a similar code in Stillwater, Oklahoma, a place that often experiences high summer temperature extremes. It will supply police and animal control personnel with an enforceable, quantifiable threshold condition to determine a violation. Chris Wall of the Sioux City Animal Adoption and Rescue Center told the council that animal cruelty cases have been thrown out in the past due to a difference of opinion with the courts about what it was considered hot weather. "It was ambiguous before, but now there is a threshold where we know we're good to prosecute a case or know we don't have a case at that point," he said. Wall noted that when the temperature outside is 80 degrees, within 10 minutes the inside of a vehicle can reach 99 degrees, and within 30 minutes it can heat up to 114 degrees. It gets real hot real quick, he said. Under the new ordinance, as well as previous language in the code, a peace officer or animal control officer is authorized to use whatever force is reasonable and necessary to remove any animal from a vehicle or other enclosed space whenever it appears that the animal's life or health is endangered by extreme temperatures or lack of ventilation. The officers would not be liable for any damages caused to the vehicle or other enclosed space. I'm somewhat supportive, but it's amazing to me that we have a dog ordinance now, but we don't have a kid ordinance. It's totally unbelievable, Mayor Bob Scott said. I'm not anti-dog or pets, but kids are a heck of a lot more important to me than a dog or a cat. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore asked if animals tend to survive being left in hot cars. Wall said animal control officers have responded to a few calls this year, but he said by the time officers arrived on the scene, the vehicles had already left. We've not actually caught anybody this year, Wall said, but as we were leaving this afternoon, there is a dead dog case that's come in from a dog that was left outside, not in a vehicle, but was left outside all afternoon. Anyone in violation of the proposed ordinance would receive a municipal infraction penalty. A first offense would be $100 plus costs for a total of $195. Five to be interviewed for Iowa High Court spot. Five applicants, including a Sioux City judge, will be interviewed for an opening on the Iowa Supreme Court that will occur when Justice Brent Appel retires next month, the court announced in a news release Monday. When Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds appoints a new justice, it will be her fifth appointment to the seven-member court. All five candidates will be interviewed next Monday, June 27th, by the state's Judicial Nominating Commission. The 17-member commission will select three finalists, after which Reynolds will have 30 days to select one of the finalists as the next justice. When she makes this next selection, Reynolds will have appointed five Iowa Supreme Court justices during her 6 years in office. Appel is the court's last remaining member who was appointed by a Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, in 2006. Appel was retained by voters in the 2016 judicial retention elections. Appel this summer turned 72, the age at which Iowa judges are required by law to retire. The five candidates scheduled to be interviewed next Monday are Patrick Tott, the 3rd District's Chief Judge from Sioux City. Tott also has interviewed for the Iowa Supreme Court opening in the past. He was one of two Iowa judges who ruled in a 2020 lawsuit that Iowa County election officials erred in mailing out absentee ballot request forms with some personal information filled in. Tott was appointed to the district court bench in September 2014 by then-Governor Terry Branstad. Timothy Garten, a lawyer with Hastings, Garten & Bolger in Ames. Garten served on the Ames City Council and in 2010 ran for the Iowa Senate as a Republican. Alan Heavens, a 1st District judge from Garnavillo. Heavens is a former Clayton County attorney. David May, an Iowa Court of Appeals judge from Polk County. May was a finalist for an Iowa Supreme Court vacancy in 2020, an opening that was filled by Matt McDermott after the retirement of former Justice David Wiggins. William Miller, a lawyer with Dorsey & Whitney in Des Moines. Miller, who specializes in business law, has interviewed for a previous Iowa Supreme Court vacancy. Rotarians honor Sue Davis, Linda Kalin. The Sioux City Rotary Club presented its top two community awards Monday to two women with a long history of serving Siouxland. Linda Kalin, executive director of the Iowa Poison Control Center in Sioux City, is a recipient of the club's Key Way Award. Sue Davis, coordinator for the Sioux City Knights Special Olympics team, received the club's Service Above Self Award. The Service Above Self Award is given to a local resident who has volunteered in the community, usually with little or no recognition or public knowledge. The award, given since 1957, cannot go to a Rotarian. Since 1986, the club has presented the Key Way Award to a local leader who has contributed to the health and prosperity of the area through business and community involvement. Kalin is a Rotary Club member. Kaelin, who has over 25 years of experience in clinical toxicology and poison center activities, was instrumental in the development of the statewide poison control center in 2000. She began her career as an emergency room nurse and in 1989 became Iowa's first certified specialist in poison information. Davis has volunteered for Special Olympics for over 35 years. She is preparing to retire in her longtime role as coordinator for the Sioux City Knights, which was established in 2013. Davis and Sioux City Knights coach volunteer Troy Bettsworth highlighted the program during the Rotary Club's meeting Monday. 12 athletes from the team competed this month at the U.S. Special Olympics in Orlando, and all of them won at least one medal. In a unified bocce ball event, Sue Davis competed with her daughter, Carrie. And now we have a correction from a previous article. Sneaky's Chicken will host a fundraiser dinner, silent auction, and live auction at Country Celebrations, 5606 Hamilton Boulevard, from 4 to 9 p.m. Sunday. In the E-Edition story, it incorrectly stated the time of the Sneaky's fundraiser. The fundraiser will benefit Hope Street of Siouxland, a sober living home for 10 men. Now we'll look at the 5-day forecast for the area. And today will be clouds and sunshine with a high of 89, which is a little cooler than the last couple of days. And then tonight will be clear to partly cloudy with a low of 61. Wednesday will be partly sunny and less humid with a high of 90 and a low of 66. Thursday it will be breezy and hot with thunderstorms at night with a high of 94 and a low of 68. Friday will be partly sunny and hot with a high of 93 and a low of 67. And Saturday will be clearing, a possible thunderstorm, not as warm, with a high of 81 and a low of 63. Our next headline is Doctor Refutes Expert Testimony in Davis Trial. Call it the case of the dueling doctors. After prosecutors on Monday called a pediatrician to rebut the testimony of a pathologist called by Tavon Davis defense team, the defense notified the court that it intended to call its expert back to the stand to counter Monday's medical testimony. The catch: he is not available until Wednesday morning, causing another delay in a trial in which jury selection began June 7th. There was no testimony Friday because Dr. Suzanne Haney, the state's rebuttal witness, was not available. When jurors were dismissed last week, they were told Monday likely would be the last day of evidence and they might receive the case for deliberations by the afternoon. The timing of things in this trial has not at any time progressed as we said it would, District Judge Todd Deck told jurors before dismissing them Monday morning after less than an hour of witness testimony. The latest delay will make it possible for the defense to recall Dr. Thomas Young, a private forensic pathologist from Kansas City, Missouri, who testified Thursday before the defense rested its case. Young said medical evidence and statements Davis has made can explain Malin Myers' injuries were accidental and not abusive, contradicting many of the conclusions previously offered by Haney and the medical examiner who did the autopsy. Davis, 26, of Sioux City, is charged in Woodbury County District Court with first-degree murder, child endangerment resulting in the death of a child, and multiple acts of child endangerment. Prosecutors believe he injured Malin numerous times in the days leading up to August 22, 2018, when Davis and Malin's grandmother rushed the unresponsive 19-month-old to a Sioux City emergency room. She was transferred to Children's Hospital in Omaha, where she never regained consciousness and died 3 days later. An Iowa State medical examiner detailed the child's injuries, which included bleeding throughout the brain, a left kidney dying because the blood vessel leading to it had been torn, hemorrhaging in both eyes, the girl's abdomen and in the muscles at the back of her neck. X-rays showed healing of fractures in the tibias of both legs and two vertebrae. All had fresh fractures in the healing bone material. At least three ribs were fractured. Malin also had bruises on her forehead and the small of her back. Malin's death was ruled a homicide caused by complications from blunt force injuries. Davis told investigators he dropped Malin after giving her a bath on August 22nd and she stopped breathing. His attempts at CPR were unsuccessful, but she was revived in the emergency room. Haney, a pediatrician at Children's Hospital who examined Malin, previously testified the girl's injuries were too severe to be caused by being dropped, and that CPR also was an unlikely cause. Returning to the witness stand Monday, Haney said Young's assertions that many of Malin's injuries could have been caused by Davis's attempts to administer CPR do not measure up to findings from numerous studies. She also disagreed with Young's explanation that hemorrhaging in Malin's eyes resulted from blood vessel damage caused by reperfusion, a condition in which blood supply to the body stops, then starts again. Haney said studies show eye hemorrhaging from reperfusion is different than if caused by traumatic injuries. The girl's arm and leg fractures were typical of twisting and pulling injuries, such as being yanked, Haney said, not CPR or frantic handling of the little girl while she was unconscious, as Young testified. Young also said Malin's broken ribs were the result of CPR. Haney said a child's bones are more flexible than an adult's and can bend much further without breaking, make it unlikely they were fractured during CPR. Haney maintained her opinion that Malin's injuries were caused by a force comparable to a car crash, not failed CPR or low-distance fall in the bathroom. It is not the result of a low-distance fall, she said. It's possible closing arguments will take place Wednesday and the case then submitted to the jury. If found guilty of first-degree murder, Davis would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Our next article is from South Dakota. What to know ahead of South Dakota Attorney General impeachment trial. South Dakota Attorney General Jason Rivensburg faces a historic impeachment trial this week for his actions surrounding a 2020 car crash in which he struck and killed a pedestrian. As the state Senate prepares to decide whether the first-term Republican Attorney General should be convicted and removed from office, here's what to know ahead of the two-day trial that begins Tuesday. Why was Rivensburg impeached? He struck and killed 55-year-old Joseph Bover as Bover was walking near the shoulder of a rural highway in September 2020. Rivensburg told a 911 dispatcher he hit something in the middle of the road and later said he believed he had hit a large animal. The next day, he returned to the crash site and said it was only then that he discovered the body. After a lengthy criminal investigation, Rivensburg pleaded no contest to a pair of traffic misdemeanors, including making an illegal lane change. Rivensburg attempted to move past the crash, but Governor Kristi Noem, a fellow Republican, pushed for his ouster. The House in April impeached Rivensburg on two counts, committing crimes that caused someone's death and malfeasance in office. What are the impeachment charges? The first charge centers on the crash and Rivensburg's driving record leading up to it. The Attorney General has broken the law, and as a result of that, one of our citizens has died, Republican Representative Will Mortensen told the House as he argued for impeachment. Mortensen said the crash was part of a disturbing pattern of driving by Rivensburg, pointing to a score of traffic tickets and warnings he had accumulated. The malfeasance charge covers a range of Rivensburg's actions. House lawmakers say Rivensburg misled law enforcement from telling a 911 dispatcher the collision happened in the middle of the road to later interviews in which criminal investigators said the Attorney General was not being straightforward and telling the truth. The House lawmakers also argue Rivensburg abused the powers of his office by using official letterhead for a statement on the incident and later questioning a Division of Criminal Investigation agent about what the crash investigators could find on his cell phone. Rivensburg has consistently denied wrongdoing and cast the Senate trial as a chance to be vindicated. What will happen at the impeachment trial? It takes two-thirds of the Republican-controlled Senate's 35 members to convict Rivensburg, which would trigger automatic removal as Attorney General. If he is convicted, senators could also bar him from holding future office with another two-thirds majority vote. They will make that decision after convening for 2 days in the first impeachment trial in state history. It will also give both sides an opportunity to openly present and examine the details of an incident that has roiled state politics for well over a year. Lawmakers have opted for a speedy trial. The impeachment prosecutors and Rivensburg defense attorney have each been allotted 1 hour for an opening statement, 4 hours for witness testimony, and 1 hour to close their arguments. That's highly constrained, highly unusual, something I've never done, said Pennington County State's Attorney Mark Vargo, who is leading the prosecution. He was initially part of the criminal prosecution team, but left before a charging decision was announced. Vargo and other prosecutors plan to present in-person witness testimonies from crash investigators, as well as former members of the Division of Criminal Investigation. The agency is under Attorney General oversight and thus was recused from the crash investigation, but Ravensburg tapped into his expertise as the North Dakota Bureau of Criminal Investigation probed his conduct. One former Division of Criminal Investigation agent fielded questions from Ravensburg about what could be extracted from his cell phone during the crash investigation, and another was asked about polygraph testing. Ravensburg has not said whether he will testify. His defense attorney, Mike Butler, will not call any witnesses. He will instead rely on cross-examination of the prosecution's witnesses as well as oral arguments. Senators may take additional time to ask additional questions and debate the articles of impeachment. They plan to vote on a verdict by the end of the day Wednesday. The Senate will vote on each impeachment article, as well as whether to bar him from holding future office in the state. What happens afterwards? The trial outcome may have implications for others besides Ravensburg. A conviction would be a victory for Noam, who has adamantly pushed for Ravensburg ouster. She said last year she was outraged at the result of the criminal investigation and suggested that impeachment could hold Ravensburg accountable. Noam would name Ravensburg's replacement until the candidate elected in the November race for Attorney General is sworn in. Ravensburg was up for re-election this year but decided not to run. Ravensburg has argued that the governor, who has positioned herself for a possible 2024 White House bid, pushed for his removal in part because he had investigated ethics complaints against Noam. His office is also investigating whether an organization aligned with the governor broke campaign finance disclosure laws. It is not clear how Ravensburg's permanent ouster would affect those investigations. Meanwhile, the South Dakota GOP is set to decide its next candidate for the Attorney General's office at a convention in the days after the Senate trial. One of Ravensburg's top aides, David Natvig, has declared his interest in the nomination and portrayed himself as someone who could continue Ravensburg's work. However, Marty Jackley, who held the Attorney General's office for roughly a decade before Ravensburg, is also vying for the GOP nomination for his old job. He has support from Noam and from much of the state's law enforcement community. Delegates from each county Republican Party will vote on an Attorney General nominee on June 25th. Cedar Rapids Democrat likely to become first Arab American Iowa lawmaker. A Cedar Rapids Democrat is poised to become the first Arab American lawmaker in the Iowa legislature. Sammy Sheets, a 26-year-old community organizer whose mother immigrated to Cedar Rapids from Damascus, Syria, is running unopposed to the Iowa House District 78 seat. The newly redrawn district has been represented by Democrat Representative Liz Bennett, who is running for an open Senate seat. If elected, Sheets said he hopes to counter what he sees as sharp and harmful anti-immigrant rhetoric from Iowa Republicans. He referenced a state law that mandates all official political documents from the state be written in English, with the exception of voting materials in two counties. And he cited Governor Kim Reynolds' rejection last year of a federal request to accept unaccompanied migrant children into the state, saying the need to find homes for them is the president's problem. Right now, there are small towns across the state of Iowa that are being revitalized by Latin American and Mexican American immigration, Sheets said. And to have that unwelcoming rhetoric from the Iowa GOP, I think, is going to be really, really problematic when the census projects by 2050 Iowa's going to be a quarter Latino. Sheets said rural Iowa's future rests on immigrants and refugees to ensure an adequate labor supply to replace those aging out of the workforce. Republican Party of Iowa Communications Director Colin Crompton responded, saying, "Iowans overwhelmingly disapprove of President Joe Biden's open border policies, which," he said, "has resulted in thousands of pounds of deadly fentanyl flowing across the border." Born and raised in Cedar Rapids, Sheets, the son of an immigrant teacher and a lawyer, said he looks forward to working to promote increased diversity and inclusion in state politics. The 78th district has a diverse electorate that includes large Latino, Arab American, and African American communities. The district also has among the lowest voter turnout rates in the state, according to Sheets. There are tons of Democrats that just have not been voting, and I think part of that is us not investing the resources and the time in connecting and turning out voters of color and immigrant communities, said Sheets, who has worked the past 10 years on political campaigns for Democratic candidates at the state and federal levels. Sheets worked on Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, helping establish satellite caucuses to encourage first-time and reluctant voters to participate. Sheets said he hopes to push for more political integration of minority groups. "We need to focus on more of that as a party," he said. While Iowa has a sizable Arab American community, with Arab immigrants settling in Cedar Rapids more than a century ago, the exact number of Arab Americans in the state is difficult to accurately measure, as their only option for describing their racial and ethnic origin on the U.S. Census forms is white. The Arab American Institute in Washington, D.C. estimated more than 17,000 Arab Americans lived in Iowa in 2017, and that at least 3.7 million lived in the United States. Recent crises and conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine have resulted in fresh waves of Arab and Muslim immigrants arriving in the United States, including more than 900 Afghan refugees who have made their home in Iowa. Sheets, who is all but guaranteed to be elected to the Iowa House from the solidly Democratic district, would become one of about 25 current state legislators across the country of Arab American descent, according to the Institute. Sheets said he also intends to focus on improving public education, access to affordable health care, and workers' rights. He said Iowa's privatization of Medicare has needlessly complicated care for countless working-class families and led to decreased service for Iowans with disabilities. Sheets, too, said he would work to restore collective bargaining rights for public employees in Iowa and push for policies like prevailing wages and project labor agreements. Sheets also worked on State Cedar Rapids Democratic Senator Rob Hogg's unsuccessful 2016 campaign for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate. Having a young person like Sammy, who has grown up in a diverse community as an Arab American, brings a perspective that will be very helpful on issues like confronting racism, hate crimes, and hate speech, Hogg said. State lawmakers last year passed, and Reynolds signed into law, a bill that bans public schools and government agencies from promoting divisive concepts in their teachings or trainings, including that the U.S. and Iowa are systemically racist or sexist. Teachers and historians say it will stifle conversations about the country's bitter legacy of slavery, segregation, and racial exclusion. "Some people feel threatened by it," Hogg said. "What Sammy is going to do is show, hey, we have to address our history, but we also have to embrace this extraordinary, diverse future if we want to be successful in the 21st century." That's where his voice will really be helpful. We'll now move to the sports section, and our first story is Sioux City Musketeers announced schedule for 2022-23 season. The 2022 USHL Clark Cup champion Sioux City Musketeers have released their 2022-23 season schedule as a part of the USHL league-wide schedule release. The 2022-23 schedule features 62 games, starting with a pair of games in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, September 22nd and 23rd, against the Green Bay Gamblers and Chicago Steel as part of the 2022 Dick's Sporting Goods USHL Fall Classic. The Musketeers' home opener will be October 8th at 6:05 p.m. against the Des Moines Buccaneers. Hockey's opening day in Sioux City kicks off with a day of celebrations and pregame activities leading up to a very special pregame ceremony where the Musketeers will raise the 2022 Clark Cup Championship banner to the rafters of the Tyson Events Center. Highlights of the 51st season of the Musketeers hockey include traditional events such as New Year's Eve, a Sioux City tradition on December 31st, and our annual military appreciation game on November 12th. On December 30th, the defending Eastern Conference champion Madison Capitals come to town for a rematch of the 2022 Clark Cup Final. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Normally, at this time, we would go to obituaries, but there are none in today's paper, so we will continue with sports. And we're going to do a prep roundup, starting with the Sergeant Bluff Luton and Council Bluffs Jefferson. Tyler Lutgen tallied two hits and three RBIs to lead Sergeant Bluff Luton to a 16-1 win over Council Bluffs Jefferson Monday. Bryce Click added three hits and two RBI for the Warriors. Braden Kerr struck out five over four innings in the win. Kyle Comer tallied one hit and one RBI for the Yellow Jackets in the loss. Kendall Bill took the loss on the mound. And then it must have been a doubleheader. So then it's the Sergeant Bluff Luton 18 and Jefferson 2. Bryce Click hit four extra base hits and drove in four RBI to lead the Warriors to an 18-2 win over Jefferson. Aiden Sierperda tallied two hits and four RBI for the Warriors. Tana Clean pitched four innings to record the win. Kyle Comer tallied two hits and two RBIs for Jefferson. Then on Saturday, North 6, Des Moines Lincoln 5. Cale Walwood tallied two hits and two RBI to lead North to a 6-5 win over Des Moines Lincoln. Eli Sedello tallied three hits and one RBI for North. Patterson McCormick took the win. West 9, Ridgeview 3. Drew Benson tallied two hits and two RBI to lead West to a 9-3 win over Ridgeview. Hunter McHugh tallied one hit and two RBI for the Wolverines. Ethan Frazee struck out four over four innings in the win. Cale Matru tallied one hit and one RBI to lead Ridgeview. West 7, Sioux Central 0. Drew Benson tallied two hits and two RBI to lead West to a 7-0 win over Sioux Central. Ryan Smith added one hit and two RBI for the Wolverines. Cale Kilbrig struck out 12 batters over six innings in the win. Jacob Hargens tallied two hits for the Rebels. Connor McKeevy pitched five innings on the loss. Remsen St. Mary 6, Kingsley Pearson 2. Alex Schroeder and Jackson Bunkers tallied two RBI each for the Hawks in a 6-2 win over Kingsley Pearson. Cale Ortman tallied one hit and one RBI for Remsen St. Mary's. Carter Shorg tallied five strikeouts over 6 2/3 innings. Damon Schmid tallied two hits for the Panthers. Boston Deschat took the loss on the mound. Sioux Central 7, Ridgeview 1. Carter Butcher and Dakota Dushley tallied three hits and one RBI each in Sioux Central's 7-1 win over Ridgeview. Bolded Bright pitched seven innings in the win. Kel Matru tallied two hits and one RBI for the Raptors. Caden Beide took the loss. OABCIG 10, Woodbine 9. Gunnar Wagner tallied one hit and two RBI to lead Woodbine to a 10-9 win over OABCIG. They got that turned around. So I'm not exactly sure who won that one, because the header said that OABCIG won and the article said that Woodbine won. So I'm not sure. Then our next one, ACGC 9, OABCIG 1. Brock Littler drove in four RBI on four hits in ACGC's 9-1 win over OABCIG. Littler also pitched five innings in the win for ACGC. Restwood 9, Logan Magnolia 7. Brody Munschroth tallied one hit and two RBI for Westwood to take the 9-7 win over Logan Magnolia. Boyer Valley 10, Westwood 7. Braden Yinst tallied three hits, including a pair of solo home runs and two RBI for Restwood in a 10-7 loss to Boyer Valley. Galen Catholic 14, West Lyon 1. Keaton Logan tallied two hits and four RBI to lead Galen Catholic to a 14-1 win over West Lyon. Hinton 10, Clarion Gofield Dowles 0. Easton Stussy tallied three hits and five RBI to lead Hinton to a 10-0 win over the Cowboys. And Unity Christian 1, Boyden Hall Rock Valley 0. Jacob Van Dong struck out six over seven innings in Unity Christian's 1-0 win over Boyden Hall Rock Valley. Now we'll move to softball. So Monday was Lamar's 3, Sergeant Bluff Luton 2. Mackenzie Kunkel tallied two hits and one RBI to lead Lamar's to a 3-2 win over Sergeant Bluff Luton. Maggie Allen added one hit and one RBI for the Bulldogs. Lizzie Kuntz struck out six over seven innings in the win. And then Saturday for softball, Akron Westfield 11, Woodbury Central 1. Natalie Olson tallied three hits and two RBI to lead Akron Westfield to a 11-1 win over Woodbury Central. West Lyon 6, Akron Westfield 4. Randy Childress hit a three-run home run in West Lions 6-4 win over Akron Westfield. And then West Lions 9, Western Christian 7, Randy Childress tallied 3 hits and 2 RBI to lead the West Lion Wildcats to a 9-7 win over Western Christian. Western Christian 4, Woodbury Central 3. Olivier Tenclay tallied 2 hits and Autumn Wolfswinkle drove in 2 RBI for the Wolfpack in a 4-3 win over Woodbury Central. Newell Fonda 4, Columbus Catholic 3. Kinsley Hinders hit a 2-run home run in Newell Fonda's 4-3 win over Columbus Catholic. Sioux Center 8, Storm Lake 6 in 8 innings. Tatum Schalmbeck tallied 3 hits and 3 RBI to lead Sioux Center to an 8-6 win over Storm Lake. Galen Catholic 1, Sioux Center 0. Riley Schneff struck out 13 batters over 7 innings and Galen Catholic's 1-0 win over Sioux Center. Logan Magnolia 10, Ridgeview 1. Gabby Mason tallied 1 hit and 1 RBI for Ridgeview in a 10-1 loss to Logan Magnolia. And that finishes the sports section for the local stories. Now we're moving to one on the economy, and the headline is 8 items that are rare bargains amid record high inflation. With inflation running at a 40-year high, an ugly 8.6% nationally, one would think everything is pricier. Actually, 93% of the 333 items tracked in the monthly inflation report were more expensive in May than they were a year ago. Source, my trusty spreadsheet reviewed the latest consumer price index for May, looking at 12-month price changes. And this is an article written by Jonathan Lansner. Well, 93% isn't 100%. So here are 8 goods and services that government inflation stats suggest might be bargains. They're likely a rare slice of the economy where consumer demand is down. So the first one is smartphones top this chart at 19.9% cheaper in a year. My guess is there's one company that hasn't come out with a killer new product in a couple of years. So with folks not rushing to buy a new cell phone, merchants are cutting prices accordingly. The second item, admissions to sporting events are 10.8% cheaper. Many teams are still suffering attendance hangovers from pandemic closings. Logic says ticket deals are being pitched to lure fans back to the ballpark or the arena. Third, televisions are 9.5% cheaper. Everyone bought a new TV, or maybe even 2, during the stay-at-home periods of the pandemic. With a back-to-kinda normal life, outdoor lifestyles seem to like a better investment. And I wonder, how many new TVs do you need? Number 4. Cruise fares are 5.3% cheaper. I'll ask a simple question. Who wants to be stuck in tight quarters with lots of strangers? Cruises are not high on the popularity list these days. Number 5. Intercity transportation, that's trains and buses, not planes, is down 3.6%. Let's just say again, crowded conditions are not popular. Operators need to incentivize customers by price. Number 6. Computer software and accessories are 3.9% cheaper. As more workers and students head back to office or classroom settings, I speculate the need to upgrade or add software to one's home computers is down. Number 7. Men's pants and shorts are 1.6% cheaper. I'm figuring guys working back at the office probably just dusted off clothing they hadn't worn in 2 years. And number 8, jewelry is 1.2% cheaper. I've read millennials are less interested in pricey bling than previous generations. Maybe they're spending all their money on buying new homes or renting at fancy apartments. Of those 333 goods and services tracked by the CPI, 39% of all goods and services tracked jumped in price by 10% or more during the 12-month period ended in May. So 39% increased by at least 10% or more, and 7% apparently went down. Our next story is about a class at Morningside University. Sociology of comic characters explored in Morningside University class. You would not ordinarily stack up the latest issue of Superman with something by Shakespeare, But Morningside University religious studies professor Elizabeth Cootie said comic books do have a special place when it comes to literature. She explained, "Comic books and graphic novels tell a story in a very visual manner. Because of that, writers and illustrators can take their readers to a different time, place, or universe." That was the premise of Cootie's 3-week May Terms course, in which students learned the history, business, and sociology of comics. She said, "While the golden age of comics occurred in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, we've recently seen a nice renaissance for many iconic characters." Acme Comics and Collectibles co-owner Kevin McGarry agrees, noting that Hollywood is paying attention to the box office appeal of comic book characters. He explained, "With the success of Batman and the Doctor Strange movies, it is a good time to be a comic book fan. The new Thor and Black Adam movies will also likely be hits this summer." McGarry's 1622 Pierce Street store was the site of a field trip for Cootie students. That included Morningside computer science major Bruce Shannon. "This is my first time in Acme," Shannon said. "It's pretty cool." While Shannon said he was into Spider-Man as a child, he had not kept up with comics prior to this class. That wasn't the case with elementary education student and self-admitted comic book nerd Cletus Peterson. "There's no age limit when it comes to comic books," he said. "I've been reading them my entire life." One aspect which Peterson especially appreciates is it is the scope of stories a comic book can tell. "You can talk about contemporary issues, historic things, and social problems in a comic book," he said. "You can do it because comics are accessible in a way that other literature isn't. Plus, you've got to admit comic books do have plenty of cool characters." "I'm a Blade fan from way back," communications major Brandon Clare said. "I don't know if it is because I was also a Wesley Snipes fan, but Blade was it for me." Which brought up an interesting point about iconic comic book characters. Most are surprisingly durable. Isn't it fascinating that Batman and Superman have been around since the 1930s, while Spider-Man debuted in the 1960s? That's a very long time. Well, Claire has a hot take when it comes to that. He said, "Batman and Superman are characters that grandpas share with their grandkids. When comic book fans of my generation become grandpas, we'll be able to share much cooler comic book characters like Blade. Or in my case, Deadpool," interjected Deb Peterson. "Well, maybe you shouldn't share Deadpool with your future grandkids," Claire said, shaking his head. "You're probably right about that," Peterson said. "Let the grandkids discover Deadpool on their own." And now we move to a story from Lamar's. Between a YouTube series and Ice Cream Day gigs, Lamar's gospel family are too busy to chill. The gospel-singing Brown family must have one heck of a to-do list. When they're not performing at the Brown Century Theater, brothers Adam and Andrew help out at their family's rural Plymouth County farm. Similarly, Sister Michaela is known to leap from the stage to the stove, testing out recipes. After all, she has 3 cookbooks to her credit. And Mom Shelley? She was the brains behind Hometown with the Browns, a twice-a-month YouTube series which gives audiences a behind-the-scenes peek at the Gospel Music Association Dove Award-nominated family. Shelley Brown explained, "We actually came up with the idea to do a reality series years ago. Then we decided to purchase a historic bank building that eventually turned into the Brown Century Theater in 2015. And as often happens," Adam said, continuing the story, "construction on a 100-year-old building took more time and more money than expected, so everything else had to be on the back burner." 7 years later, Michaela remembered her mom's reality TV concept. That was when the family began producing Hometown with the Browns. "Each episode has a different song as its theme," Shelley said. "Michaela will demonstrate a new recipe. Adam and Andrew will have a fun What's Up with the Brown Boy segment. A lot of times that will be a home improvement spot, which is Adam's specialty," interjected Andrew. "Plus, every show ends with a word of inspiration, courtesy of Mom," Michaela said. "But the main thing is it showcases our music as well as our hometown," Shelley said. "We do love Lamar's." Okay, so the Brown family presented Oh My Iowa, a musical salute to the Hawkeye State, last Thursday and Friday, and as part of the Lamar's Ice Cream Day celebration. Home to Wells Enterprises and Blue Bunny Ice Cream, the ice cream capital of the world was a site for a multitude of family-friendly activities. In addition to the Browns, Oh My Iowa show, and their Ice Cream Day's outdoor closing show concert, the Plymouth County seat had plenty of stuff to see and do. This year's Ice Cream Days will be very different from past festivals, according to Executive Planning Committee member Shannon Rodenberg. For years, Ice Cream Days was a time for the community to come together for a celebration. This year, revamped the festival as a way to bring out-of-towners to Lamar's. Well, such time-tested events as car show, smile contest, and ice cream social will continue. But Rodenberg is excited about the new activities like a carnival with midway rides and an ice cream-themed performance from the Omaha Arts Circus. In addition, there were daily scavenger hunts where visitors could spot historic highlights on downtown buildings, and alley art exploration tours featuring public displays and the large-scale murals on the alley walls of local businesses. Event organizers wanted to bring as much of Ice Cream Days to downtown Lamar's, Rodenberg said. That included street performers, live artists, food vendors, merchant mart, and a kids zone in or near the Olson Culture Events Center. With gas prices as high as they are, more people are sticking closer to home, Rodenberg said. That's why most of the Ice Cream Day events are either free or inexpensive for families. Which is a sentiment shared by the Browns, whose theater often brings in busloads of visitors to see their shows or shop in their next-door gift and chocolate shop. There is something wonderfully inviting about visiting a small town in the summertime, Shelley Brown said. Ice Cream Days is the time of the year when Lamar's can show off what made it famous all over the world. Now have a couple of short stories under the headline Siouxland Strange. The first one, a dispute between two homeless men near the Anderson Dance Pavilion ended with one of them jailed for stabbing the other in the face with a pair of scissors. The incident took place at approximately 5:36 a.m. June 1st, when the two men had been sleeping near each other. According to court documents, Tommy Barton, 38, became angry with the other man and stabbed and sliced him at least three times in the face, causing severe lacerations. The victim's left eye later swelled shut while being treated at a hospital. Police found Barton a short distance from the scene, and he threw away a pair of scissors after seeing the officers. Police retrieved the scissors, which were wet and appeared to have just been washed, court documents said. The victim later identified Barton as his assailant. According to court documents, Barton told police while being transported to jail that prior to the stabbing, the victim had been kicking Barton's belongings and rubbing his butt on them. Barton said the victim also was touching him while he was sleeping, and that was why he assaulted him. Barton was booked into the Woodbury County Jail on one count of willful injury causing serious injury. And then our next story. A Rock Rapids woman was arrested after authorities say she ran over a sheriff's deputy's foot while driving away to avoid talking to him about a car accident. The Lyon County Sheriff's Deputy responded to a single vehicle rollover at approximately 6:06 p.m. May 30th on U.S. Highway 75 south of Rock Rapids. According to court documents, the deputy pulled up to the scene to talk to the driver, who was standing on the side of the highway, and told the deputy that one of the minor passengers had pulled the emergency brake, causing him to roll the vehicle. In the meantime, Mandy Davis was pulling away from the scene with the three passengers, all of whom were under age 18. The deputy followed her in his vehicle and, noticing a brake light was not working, stopped to identify and talk to the children who had been in the rollover. According to court documents, Davis told the deputy she was taking the children to the hospital but had passed it already. The deputy told her to turn around and go to the hospital where he would meet her. At the hospital, Davis took the three boys inside and came back out with two of them, who refused to tell the deputy their names. As they got back in her car, Davis told the two boys, who were not her children, not to talk to the deputy. Davis then drove over the front of the deputy's foot while jumping the curb and leaving the parking lot, driving recklessly and at a high speed of rate of high speed, court documents said. The deputy and a backup officer pursued her to her home, where she had gotten out of the car and run inside with the two children. The deputy and the other officer followed her inside the house and chased her around a table before catching her. Davis continued to resist arrest while being handcuffed, court documents said. We'll now move to Dear Abby, our first letter. Dear Abby, I got pregnant at 15 and had my oldest daughter at 16. I met my husband at 18 and went on to have four more daughters. I have been with him for more than 30 years. I just turned 49. My girls are living their own lives now. The thing is, now that I'm alone with my husband, I have come to discover that we have nothing in common. I want to leave him, but I have no money, no car, no job. I've become someone I never thought I would be, alone with no life. My husband ignores me and drinks a lot. When we visit family, it's a free-for-all drunk fest for him. I just don't have the energy at my age to deal with a drunk. I dealt all my life with an alcoholic father, and I don't want to do it anymore. How do I begin to rebuild my life and start over? I really need to do this for myself. Signed, At a Crossroads in Ohio. And Avery responds, I agree that rebuilding your life is something you need to do for yourself. The surest way to accomplish it would be to get a job. That may eventually equip you to survive on your own. If you need transportation, ask your daughters for help or take public transportation. If you prefer not to attend family gatherings, have your husband go alone. Your father's alcoholism may have contributed to the fact that you married someone with an alcohol problem, thinking it was normal. If that's the case, consider finding a nearby chapter of Al-Anon or Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families, and attend some of the meetings. They are sometimes held online, so if you could do it on a computer, if necessary, I wish you luck on your journey. Then our next letter. Dear Abby, I am a widow with three serious illnesses, one of which is potentially deadly. I hesitate to confide in some of my friends because the majority of them go into a litany of their illnesses. For the most part, their ailments are common and require just a small change in diet or perhaps losing some weight. What makes it uncomfortable for me is they act like they are in a life-threatening situation, which they are not. I find it increasingly difficult to empathize with their common colds, achy joints. How can I explain to these folks how much they upset me? For the most part, they are good people, just very self-centered. Signed, Challenged in New Hampshire. And Abby responds, It may be unrealistic to expect friends who don't know about your serious medical conditions to empathize with you or stop complaining about their aches and pains. Rather than say their complaints are annoying, tell them the truth about what's going on with you. After that, try to remember that regardless of how minor, every person's health challenges are important to them, even if on the grand scale of things they don't seem that way to you. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 21st. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Food and Drug Administration has announced two drug recalls this week. Sandoz is pulling all of its prescription ranitidine capsules because testing detected a suspected carcinogen called NDMA. Health authorities in Canada, much of Europe, and Taiwan have already issued recalls for Zantac and generic ranitidine. The FDA has not yet asked other U.S. distributors to pull their ranitidine products. Ranitidine is an H2 antagonist used to treat ulcers and acid reflux. In addition, Torrent Pharmaceuticals is recalling multiple lots of the blood pressure drug Losartan. This action is related to detection of the impurity NMBA. This nitrosamine compound is also a probable human carcinogen. Torrent has now recalled more than 300 lots of blood pressure medicines during the past year.
Aspirin has been getting mixed reviews lately. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology said that low-dose aspirin should only be used by older people at high risk of strokes or heart attacks. Others, they said, would be more likely to be harmed. Now, though, researchers from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center report that patients with head and neck cancer have a better chance of survival if they take low-dose aspirin while undergoing treatment. An additional 8% of patients taking the 81 milligram daily dose were still alive 5 years after treatment compared to those not taking aspirin. A different study at Roswell Park compared aspirin versus no aspirin among 164 patients being treated for early-stage non-small cell lung cancer. The patients got precision radiation therapy. 2 years after treatment, 57% of those taking low-dose aspirin were still alive compared to 48% of those who did not take the drug. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has also recommended that obstetricians consider recommending low-dose aspirin to patients at risk of preeclampsia. This complication of pregnancy can be extremely serious for both mother and baby. Women taking low-dose aspirin are 24% less likely to develop preeclampsia.
Scientists suggest that the Puerto Rican culinary tradition of incorporating sofrito into many dishes might help explain a lower rate of breast cancer there. This condiment is made with onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and a related herb, rucao. Epidemiologists found that Puerto Rican women who ate lots of garlic and onions, including sofrito, were 67% less likely to get breast cancer than those who never ate sofrito. The total intake of onions and garlic was important, not only the use of sofrito. The researchers point out that onions and garlic are rich in flavanols and sulfur-containing compounds that have anti-cancer activity.
Despite lots of information about how to eat healthfully, Americans are still getting too much of their energy from low-quality carbohydrates. Nutrition scientists drew this conclusion from analyzing nutrition health and examination survey data from 1999 to 2016. Although the American diet got a little better over that time frame, the change was modest. Only 9% of calories in a typical American diet come from whole fruits and whole grains. About 42% comes from highly refined grains, added sugar, and starchy vegetables such as potatoes. The estimated healthy eating index went from 55.7 to 57.7. Although this change is statistically significant, it leaves plenty of room for improvement.
Americans are often exhorted to walk on the sunny side or look for the silver lining. Can such a cheery attitude influence your health? A recent meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open suggests that optimistic individuals are less likely to suffer heart attacks, strokes, angina, and death from cardiovascular causes. The analysis included 15 studies with a total of more than 200,000 participants. A pessimistic attitude increased people's risk of cardiac problems. The author suggests that health professionals might want to come up with interventions to reduce pessimism and promote optimism, especially in cardiac rehab programs. They express the hope that their study might stimulate research into the heart benefits of a sense of purpose or gratitude. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.